Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hello and welcome to the Times Business Podcast, where we're going to be taking a close look at some of the events that will be moving markets in the coming days. I'm Robert Miller. This week, that means looking at the future prospect for oil investors in the global and domestic arenas and whether housing stocks really are, well, as we used to say, as safe as we once thought they were. I'm joined by Marcus LaRue, the Times trade correspondent, Tom Knowles, our economics and property correspondent, and Callum Jones, the Times markets reporter. Welcome to you all. Now, on November the 30th, members of the OPEC oil cartel and, of course, other big producers like Russia will meet to discuss whether to extend the output cuts that have been placed for nearly a year. That's going to be taking place in Vienna, and Emily Gosden, our energy editor, will be there. Let's first remind ourselves where we are. This is how Mohamed Sanusi Barkindo, he's the OPEC Secretary General, set the scene earlier this month at the launch of OPEC's World Oil Outlook for 2017.
Since the publication of the World Oil Outlook 2016 in early November last year, the oil market has undergone significant and fundamental changes. It has been a period where the rebalancing of the global oil market has gathered momentum, buoyed by a number of important factors. The main focus has been on the historic production adjustment decisions reached by OPEC and participating non-OPEC producers at the end of 2016, and then extended in May of this year for a further period of 9 months until the end of March 2018.
Marcus, you have covered these conventions before in Vienna. Just set the scene for us. I mean, how likely is it that they say they'll meet and that they will come to a decision? Do we expect a cast iron decision from them?
I think the consensus out there seems to be that there'll be another rollover, a 9 month rollover in the production cuts, which would take what Mr. Barkindo mentioned there, the end of March through to the end of 2018. There are, as ever with OPEC politics, a lot of moving parts. And the geopolitics are never far from the horizon. You have relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia looming large, as ever as they have over the last few years. And lots of players like the Russians that could do with expanding out, but at the same time don't want to risk prices crashing, because that would be even worse for their exchequer and the chances of them balancing the budget. So I expect that most of the OPEC members at the moment are quite happy with this happy balance. You know, they can live with oil being in the 60s. Which isn't quite high enough to set the hair racing and to excite the men in Stetsons who, you know, who are going to venture off into Texas and Louisiana and the Midwest to frack the living daylights out of shale formations. So that's the sort of the balance they have there that they want. You know, they want prices to be high, but not so high that they let the American frackers come back to the party and open the door to another longer medium-term wave of production increases. That's in his coded way, that was what he was talking about when he said the fundamental rebalancing of the market.
We shouldn't obviously lose sight of the fact that since confidence has been kind of restored in the curb since they were announced, was it earlier this year, last year? It feels like it's all a bit of a blur right now. But since confidence has been restored, the impact on prices has been clear. Brent crude, I think, is still at roughly a two-year high, having bottomed out at about $40 in 2016 per barrel. It's now around $64 per barrel as we sat here. So you can see that very clearly the impact that it's had on prices. And when they meet next week, they'll be adamant that they want to try and keep prices at that kind of level.
And I think that the dynamic is interesting because unconventional onshore US production has become so much more efficient that those guys, the best of them, can actually make it work at these price levels. I remember hearing a quite funny conversation in Davos. Sorry, that's just a horrendous sentence to have to utter. But
been to Davos.
I've been
several times.
I'm quite important. But it was two American oil men saying after prices had got as low as sort of below $30 at $1.27 a barrel, I think at one point Brent crude, and they were looking back a year later and saying things are looking up. The market works. Guess what? Even in this rigged market with an oligopoly or a cartel trying to pull the levers, the fundamentals still play out. And these guys weren't, they weren't pulling their hair out saying, "When will $100 oil come back?" They were sitting, having quite a complacent conversation when oil was probably back then even in the 50s, as far as I remember.
We've got this massive global supply glut, Marcus, and obviously, as you say, the American frackers in particular have found a way now to produce at much lower cost per barrel. Is that going to distort it, or is it really still not large enough? I mean, you referred earlier to fracking the hell out of the States. I mean, is it possible that at these levels we might see the rig count start to go up and therefore contribute to global supply gluts?
You might. What seems to have happened so far is that the US really acts as the new swing producer, and which is why it's harder for oil to soar out of that. They call it the shale band of, I think it's moved where people have it, but say broadly, it used to be 40 to 60 and maybe now it's possibly a wee bit lower. You're not going to see it much above that, because after a while, once it does, you'll begin to see the rig count rise, more marginal wells being brought back on stream, and the price gets brought back down to earth. So it's a sort of way of keeping keeping OPEC and the Middle East honest in that sense. And of course, the other thing to mention is that while the rig count flies around madly, production actually didn't go down all that much because it was the most efficient guys who were left in the game, and they were ramping up production and doing more from their pads. They were drilling longer laterals and getting more out of what they had, the infrastructure they had, and it was the more marginal players that were packing up and going home. So there is always a bit of there was certainly during that period of 2014 to 2016, there was a decoupling between the rig count and production onshore US.
All right. Well, let's take a closer look at home and listen to Philip Hammond. He gave the North Sea operators and investors a budget boost. This is what he had to say.
From November 2018, we will introduce transferable tax history for transfers of oil and gas fields in the North Sea, an innovative tax policy that will encourage new entrants to bring fresh investment to a basin that still holds up to 20 billion barrels of oil.
Tom Knowles, in economic terms, is this a genuine break for UK oil and gas operators? I mean, will it go to work immediately?
Well, it could be. The key thing is that basically there's quite a lot of maturing oil fields in the North Sea, and companies can usually claim tax relief when they decommission these fields, plugging up the oil pipe and sort of removing the infrastructure. But that's based on how much tax they've paid over the time they've owned it. So when they transfer it to a different buyer, under current rules until yesterday, none of that was transferred. So, someone decommissioning a field would have to pay a lot more if they had bought the field, in the later years of its maturity. So what he's saying is this could bring in lots of investment. It could also bring in smaller companies who are usually put off from buying these, fields that are near the end of their lifetime. But the key thing is that the chance, the hopes it will bring in more tax again, because in 2009, North Sea oil receipts were contributing about 12 billion a year in tax. Now it's down to about 900 million. So it's a huge moneymaker for the government if it can be pushed up again. And they reckon this change will possibly contribute as much as 40 billion over time to the government. But, the devil's in the detail, and people are saying, well, you'll have to be careful to look at the actual legislation that comes in for this.
Looking at the stock market reaction, Callum, would you say that, I was just thinking INEOS, for example, has just recently mopped up some fields from BP and others, very interested. But there are smaller companies, aren't there? Mobile oil explorers who, presumably this for them is a big deal. or could be a big deal, as Tom says, provided the devil's in the detail, Zion Dow.
It is, but the key thing about the reaction over the past few days is that it's been actually quite muted, because like much of the budget, it was briefed a few days, if not a few weeks in advance, so people knew it was coming. And the interesting thing about the stock market reaction to the budget a few days ago was that whilst many people would picture the city tuning in and watching on television glued to their screens, those who did actually felt like it was time wasted, or many of them certainly did, because there weren't really many surprises in the grand scheme of things. I think the pound didn't even gain a cent against the dollar. House builders were up at 1 minute and then they were down the next, because at the end of the day, we were expecting a lot of this. Lots of this was in the press. Lots of this Philip Hammond had announced quite openly the day before, let alone get aides to brief to various journalists. So there weren't really many surprises.
I mean, you mentioned housing there specifically, and we've seen, I mean, so many people, investors and listeners, have house builders, they have the real estate investment trust, they're looking for income. I mean, this is important to them, isn't it? Were the housing breaks enough, do you think, to actually excite a proper stock market rally over the coming weeks and months? Or again, are we all doomed to disappointment?
Well, the early sign, and obviously Tom will know about this a lot more than me, but in terms of the house building stocks, the early signs weren't particularly great. There wasn't an immediate rally after Philip Hammond sat down. In terms of the things that investors were talking about on Wednesday, well, this is 300,000 new builds per year target by the mid-2020s. But the devil is in the detail was the point that kept coming up again and again yesterday, because they're not entirely sure how the government plans to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I think stocks, house building stocks, went down a bit because Hammond also announced that they would be launching an inquiry into land banking, which is this theory that house builders hold onto a plot of land, wait for its value to go up, and then slowly release a supply of homes all the time, making profit. House builders always strenuously deny this and say it's rubbish. So I have a feeling this inquiry will not reveal much. Lots of reports have been done into the land bank in the past and haven't really found anything conclusive. But the 300,000 target, for me, it's just a target sort of plucked out of thin air in a way. I mean, for ages, they've had a target of 250,000 homes a year. And last year, we got to 217,000, which was the highest since 2008. And only the second highest since 2000. No, since 1990, that was it. So, you know, I just don't believe that's going to happen anytime soon. And they would have to put huge investment. I mean, Hammond announced this $44 billion of new money, he said, for housing. And actually, in the once again, devil in the detail, it turned out to be $15 billion of new money, with the rest sort of being stuff that had already been allocated over the past year or so. So it all just felt, I think, for the housing market, apart from this stamp duty cut for first-time buyers, it all felt a bit of a damp squib. And I don't think will increase affordability or supply hugely.
Worth pointing out also on the general market reaction was that although it was quite muted on the day, one thing that if the commentariat is to believe that the budget statement did is it kept Philip Hammond in place. It helped him, if he ever has to make the case to stay in his job, at a reshuffle over the coming weeks and months. Certainly commentators and those who responded to the budget suggest that actually this was quite a welcome statement on that front. If that's not true, if he does leave his job, if there is a more ardent Brexiteer that takes his place, then you can expect a much bigger reaction in the stock market.
Yeah, going on to Hammond's popularity, it seems that this stamp duty cut for first-time buyers, where he's removed stamp duty for all homes up to £300,000 for first-time buyer and same up to £500,000 for the first £300,000 of that purchase price, is apparently a huge vote winner, despite the IFS and the OBR saying that this policy is silly in a way, because all it does is push up house prices, because now first-time buyers apparently have more of money to spend on a deposit. And actually, the result is net negative, and they thought it would only contribute to about 3,000 more sales than would otherwise have happened. So it seems a bit ridiculous, but the voters seem to like it.
Voters own homes.
The voters own homes, yeah. True. That's, yeah, of course, because they see their house prices go up. So as the OBR said, it benefits homeowners more than first-time buyers.
One assumes that first-time buyers who bought on November 21st probably won't be voting Tory at the next general election, though.
I think they'll be furious.
Well, on that happy note, we'll end it there. That's it for now. But thanks to you all, and do keep up to date with the latest financial news. And in the coming days, there's going to be a veritable host of companies reporting. Pets at Home, Pennon, Britvic and Marston's. That's just to name a few. There's all that and the other news and analysis. As we said, Emily Gosden, our energy editor, will be in Vienna reporting from that crucial OPEC meeting. And you can keep up to date on your phone, tablets and in the paper. If you are a subscriber, sign up to our daily morning and lunchtime business emails. If you aren't, go to thetimes.co.uk. If you want to hear us weekly, please do subscribe through iTunes. It makes it all so much easier. My thanks to Callum Jones, Marcus LaRue and Tom Knowles. They're all on Twitter, so please do follow them. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.